Okay, good morning. How's everyone? There we go. So, as usual, we're going to begin with a little bit of meditation, try to set a good motivation. Also practice the ability for us to watch our own mind. So sit comfortably. Sit with your back straight, erect, and begin by watching your breathing, observing it. With the wisdom factor that recognizes when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. As your breathing is something that you've become familiar with, you can apply the mental factor of mindfulness. Remember, mindfulness itself takes an object that you have already understood, become familiar with. So if your mind is wandering onto other thoughts, bring it back to the object of the breathing. Hold it there with the factor of mindfulness. Don't be satisfied with just a superficial watching, because part of your mind may be then engaged in other thoughts. Delve down deeply. Try to watch the process in detail, even as the breath changes direction from inhalation to exhalation. And then when it, at the end of the exhalation, when it begins the inhalation, and then as before, follow one breath up your nostrils as though it goes to the crown of your head, to your throat, to your heart chakra, and leave it there, leave your attention there, and begin to observe the mind. Let go of the observation of your breathing. Now focus on the contents of your mind and at first, and then the nature of the mind, which is the basis within which those objects are appearing, like a clear sky. Images and thoughts that appear to your mind are not mind itself, otherwise they would be clear and knowing. They are of the nature of the mind. They are known. Let them dissolve back into the spaciousness of your mind by depriving them of the attention that they need in order to be sustained. Your consciousness, your mental consciousness, is not an object of sight, nor sound, touch, and so forth. So let go of your attention to the senses. Don't think that the appearance of your mind, which you're trying to get a mental image of, is something you can think of as shape and color. It's something that's known by your wisdom eye, rather than your physical eye. Standing that this consciousness is unobstructing, is reflective like a mirror, whatever presents itself to the mind takes up that aspect. And as opposed to a crystal or a piece of glass, it's clear. The mind also experiences or knows its objects. Let go of the appearance of your body that's arising within your consciousness, your mental consciousness. It is appearing just as a mental image to your mental consciousness, like these other thoughts, images. If it keeps on appearing there, remind yourself that it is being cognized by consciousness, and try to perceive that the nature of that consciousness to which it is appearing, rather than focusing on the object itself. As you begin to get a mental image of the consciousness, even let go of that, recognizing your mental image is as yet just a approximation, just an approximation of the mind, the nature of the mind, and try to delve in more deeply to perceive the actual consciousness that is perceiving that mental image of the mind. within this clear light nature, there still will be an appearance of yourself as an observer, as the other thoughts begin to subside. Ask yourself, who's meditating? Try to watch this with a little fish of analysis that doesn't disturb the stability of your mind, the stability of the calmness that's focused on the clear light nature. But notice this subtle appearance to the mind of a sense of an observer that's of a different nature than the mind. Let me say a dualistic appearance. The appearance of a self-identity has followed us through all of our lifetimes. The nature of that identity, of course, differs when we're a hungry ghost or an animal or a hell being, but occurs within our mind. The real problem arises with our belief in that appearance. Not something superficial, intellectual, but the innate grasping to that appearance as actually true. Adhering to it, accepting it, assenting to its existence. See with the little fish of analysis, that is to say, one part of your mind without disturbing the rest, both observing the appearance of the I, the self, and also observing, investigating how the mind is reacting to that appearance, whether the rest of the mind is assenting to that, accepting that, or whether it's disbelieving that appearance. That an I, a person, a self, is appearing to your consciousness as though being the meditator. the mind reacts to that by accepting, conceiving that there is some real self there. That's the what's called this conceived object. An independent inherently existing I. Inherently existing in the sense that it's not something which is merely nominal, merely named. Seems to be existing there from its own side. This factor of believing, adhering, assenting to the existence of that conceived object is the first link of the 12 links, the first link of ignorance. It's present in all of our actions, whether they be virtuous or non-virtuous. So we create karma that keeps us within the 12 links, within cyclic existence. Although this has to be countered by its antidote, the wisdom that recognizes that the inherently existing I that we conceive of is actually empty, does not exist in the way that it appears. Just now, just let go of this appearance in the same way we've let go of other thoughts. Let your consciousness abide in a unified, non-dualistic state, just consciousness observing itself, no sense of an observer other than the consciousness itself. Diving into the consciousness, that sense of duality, merging with the consciousness. And feel some joy in recognizing that we have the ability right now to investigate this nature of our mind and of ourselves due to having created causes in past lives, to have a life of leisure and endowment right now, perfect human rebirth. Having met the Dharma that was taught by the Buddha, sustained by the spiritual community, I have a chance of leaving imprints in my mind now to escape from cyclic existence, to further to achieve enlightenment as I begin to turn my attention to the plight of others, all of whom, all living beings who have been my mother numberless times in the past, some more recently than others, who all experience the same desire to be free of suffering and to be happy, to have pleasant experiences. Feeling their suffering, especially their ignorance, the suffering of their ignorance, having ignorance that prolongs their stay in cyclic existence, finding that unbearable. Wishing to alleviate that from the minds of others, yet knowing that we are not yet even in a position to alleviate our own ignorance, I think that I'm going to accumulate the wisdom factors by listening to the teachings today to help understand my mind to how to escape from cyclic existence. And also with that motivation to do so, not only to escape from cyclic existence for myself, but to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others, accumulating merit, the collection of merit that supports a collection of wisdom. I'm going to listen to the teachings this morning with that intention, with the goal of achieving enlightenment for the sake of benefiting all sentient beings, to alleviate each and every one of their sufferings, to achieve all their happiness and every aim, I'm going to participate this morning with that goal in mind. And then bring your attention back to the present. Relax. How was your meditation? How was yours? It's Margie, right? How was your meditation? Like this? Was you could not focus? Okay. It's hard at first. At first, if we only do a short time, we get the feeling, oh, this, nothing works. But you have to have the same determination if you've learned some activity like yoga or playing tennis. Do you play ping pong in Singapore? No. If you have to learn how to play ping pong, take some time, you know, to leave a sort of habit energy. So after some time, you can withdraw your attention from other distracting thoughts just to your consciousness. Take some time. But it's worthwhile. Anyone have any question? You have to excuse my voice. I have not spoken for a while, so.
Yeah. mental.
So when you mention the mental, the mind consciousness, observing the mind, mm-hmm. the nature of the mind, but you'd ask us not to pay attention to the visualization or the sound aspects, the senses.
To the which aspect?
To the... I thought you meant not to focus on the visual aspects, appearance, and the sound, but instead to look at the actual nature of the mind.
Right.
But what I wasn't clear on was that, is it therefore, when you're observing, is it therefore a feeling as opposed to like a visual imagery or sound?
So, yeah, here what I mean is that we still refer to what is occurring to our consciousness as an appearance, but not appearance in the sense of a visual appearance that has a shape or color. It's something that is going to be appearing to your wisdom eye. Okay, so what does that mean?
Hmm.
Your wisdom eye. Sometimes people talk about the third eye. You ever hear, like, when I first came to India, there was a book by a gentleman called Losam Rampa called The Third Eye. It was back in the 70s and 60s. It turned out to be an English mailman, postal delivery man, who wrote these books about some Tibetan monk called Losang Rampa. And one of the titles of one of the books was The Third Eye, that he supposedly had an operation to open his third eye so he could see reality. So when we talk about the wisdom eye, we're not talking about some other organ. We're talking about the ability of the consciousness to use its the consciousness to use its wisdom factor, that is developing an understanding that the mind is unobstructed, so like my hand moving here without any obstruction in space, that the mind arises, that to the mind appearances arise of whatever presents itself to the mind. That is, if our mind turns its attention to yesterday or to a friend, appearances of those will arise to the mind in the same way that a reflection arises within a mirror without any effort, just presenting something before the mirror. If our hand presents itself before the mirror, there is a reflection of our hand in the mirror, and our face is reflected in the mirror. If our face appears before it. In the same way, whatever presents itself to our mind, the mind arises in its aspect. That's another way of understanding that clarity. So we're beginning to develop a mental image of this clarity of the mind, which is not an object of sight. When I mentioned sound, I was just saying it's not something that you... that has a, that is an object of ear consciousness, nor nose consciousness, tongue or tactile consciousness. Usually the main thing that we may is try to get a mental image as though it's like blue sky or, the clouds are gone from the sky. That's an approximation, but even when we talk about space or sky, we can apprehend with our eye consciousness a kind of space that we call intermediate space, the space between my eye and your body right now. I can say I see some space there. What I see is not actual space, but I can it's what's called intermediate space, so it is space, but it's not the deeper meaning of space, which is simply the lack of obstructing contact. I can understand mentally that there's no obstructing contact between my eye and you, mentally, that doesn't have the same appearance as this intermediate space. So that's what I was trying to get at there. When we're developing a mental image of this, of the mind, and that's what we're doing right now, we're not actually having a direct experience of it. We can get maybe, even as we get a mental image of that spaciousness of the mind with our wisdom, even let go of that and as though try to sense the actual consciousness, how the actual clarity of the consciousness is there, letting go again and again. Okay. I don't know if that's satisfying. Yeah. She's speaking loud enough that I think sometimes the static of that one... Yeah, try it again. Yeah.
So the apprehension by the wisdom eye, the third eye...
Yeah, it's not really up here. I said that's kind
no,
of what...
Yes, but metaphorically, the third eye. That cognition aspect, does it manifest in the form of a feeling, would you say? Because although you mentioned it doesn't...
It doesn't appear in the same way. Like, for instance,
you can feeling.
If you think of your mom's face, that face is appearing to you in the mental image of the face is appearing to you in the same way that your eye would see your mother's face. Here, what we're trying to see with the mental consciousness is not a mental image that is like your mother's face, which is an object which has shape and color, but more of an intuition, an understanding. The word feeling, a little bit different, usually we reserve that in Buddhism to refer to one of the 12 links that we talked about last time. Feeling is... a mental factor which experiences either pleasure, unpleasant, or neutral feelings. So it's not here, we wouldn't use that word, but you might, I think you're using it in the way that most people do, like just like an intuition. I have a feeling there's someone in the room with me here. Sense. Yeah. So in that sense, yes, you can say that you're sensing that the nature of the mind. You're developing a sense of that, a mental image of that, a mental picture of that, but not picture in the sense of visual picture. So. The example that I sometimes give is if you go to the aquarium, I've been a couple times now to Sentosa. Have you been to the big aquarium? All the sharks and things going through there. Have you been? Yeah, okay. So the water itself generally is transparent. I think they keep it pretty clean. So if you, first when you look beyond the glass wall, what catches your eye are the fish and maybe the seaweed or other things within it. You don't immediately sense the clarity of the water because the existence of the water as a medium within in which the fish are moving. You see the fish moving, but if someone were to say to you, don't focus on the fish, but focus on the space between the fish, the medium within which the fish are moving. And as you do, you start to notice as a fish moves by, you notice that it's not impeded in its travel through the water. So that leaves a sense, an impression, an understanding in your mind that this medium within which the fish are moving or I would say the fish-like thoughts, doesn't impede their movement. It's unobstructing. So in the same, so in analogy to our mind, we develop, as we watch the thoughts coming and going, we're developing that sense, if you will, that understanding, or mental image of the consciousness is not impeding, is having that factor of being immaterial, because usually something which is physical and material, like this mug, if a fish were to swim against the mug, it wouldn't be able to penetrate through the mug. It would be obstructed by it. So there's a sense that there's something there in the water, in the sky also, the birds flying through the sky, so forth. Another example that can be used to develop this sense or mental image. I'm glad you brought that up, because saying mental image, although that's generally what we would translate, can give the mistaken impression it's something visual. So sense, it's using your sixth sense, your mental consciousness, not your eye sense or ear sense or nose, taste, touch sense. So developing that takes some time, but it is very, very beneficial to develop that mental image, that sense of the mind. Eventually, we will be able to experience it directly. The mind, one part of the mind, will actually have a direct perception of the clear light nature of the mind. But because it's a hidden phenomena, it's not something, a hidden phenomenon, it's not something that we can perceive from the beginning without depending on some logical reasoning. Like, say, for instance, you can't sense a fire within a trash fire within a big barrel or a cement circular, tube that's used to burn trash, but you can see the smoke coming out, and you can therefore billowing out. It's not just dust billowing out, it's smoke coming out. So you can logically infer that there's fire within that, even though you don't see it from the distance. If you come over and look over the edge of the container, you can see the actual fire. So it is something you can eventually see directly. Here, the mind is like that also. You can't sense that clear light nature of the mind at first, like the fire, but you can begin to logically infer its clear light nature. You're getting a mental image of it. Okay. So, anyone else have a question that is burning in their mind? Yes. Another burning question. Okay. After I use the example of the burning fire. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Venerable. Yeah. I'd like to say first of all that... I'd like to say first of all that all this teaching has been very helpful in furthering my understanding.
Oh, okay. Good.
So
okay.
I just want a little clarification, because when I was revising the 12 links, I read again from this book, Geshe Repton's teaching long time ago on the 12 links. And he said that there are two main ways of presenting the 12 links. The scriptural way, which explains them in terms of how samsara evolves in general, and the experiential way, which explains them in terms of how they are experienced by an individual over a continuum of lifetimes. And these two systems differ slightly in the way the order of the 12 links is presented. So can I just clarify, how are we understanding it in this teaching with you?
Hopefully both ways.
Okay.
So does Geshe-la explain there, or does he just mention that fact? Which was what the Yeah.
I'm going to explain them second way how they experience.
Right. Okay. Okay. So, let's see. If you talk about the 12 links, how many lifetimes does it take to experience the 12 links? One life? One or two? Okay, you said one, and then you said one or two. Have you read that section, or you just started to read it, so you don't know yet what he said? How many lives does he say, does Geshe-la say according to the, what did he say, the experiential as opposed to the scriptural? Pardon? It goes on forever, so yeah. Sometimes the explanation is so long that you don't come to the final conclusion.
It's just so that I'm just a bit clearer after this teaching how we are proceeding with what we've understood.
Right. So let's go into a little more detail. So last time we got a general idea of these 12 links. And when I asked Kam, so how many, so Joy said one, or Joy, right? Said one, pardon? And you go, one or two lifetimes, she thinks. Okay, Cece's shaking her head with a little bit of like, that's not right. How many lifetimes, Cece? Two or three. So we've got one or two, two or three. You say one? One. Okay, we could take a vote. Do you think it would be legitimate to take a vote on the existence of the law of gravity? You know, like the American Congress would hold a vote on whether the law of gravity exists, should exist. There shouldn't be a law of gravity. We're going to re-legislate. You can't legislate or vote on reality, right? I was just getting an idea of what your understanding is. So we can't, that's not how you decide. It's not like the Buddha sort of took a poll of all sentient beings, whether the self existed or something like that. So let's see. Let's talk about this. So I'll read you something from the Lamrim Chemo, Lama Tsongkhapa's great treatise on the stages of the path. The commentary by Geshe Sopa, who was one of my teachers. He gave a very extensive teaching over many years. Commentary, his own commentary to Lama Tsongkhapa's Lamrim Chemo. So in his section on the 12 links, he says, having identified each of the 12 links, we now analyze the meaning of this sequence from various points of view. Now, you remember Asanga? Do you remember I'm mentioning Asanga? It was one of two brothers who were very influential. Asanga was, from the very beginning, a practitioner of the Mahayana. He wrote a great text called... he wrote many texts. He had visited Maitreya in Tushita Heaven. He brought down five texts. But he wrote other texts, one of which is called the Abhidharma Samuchaya, which is sort of like considered the Mahayana Abhidharma. His brother Vasubandhu wrote a text called the Abhidharma Kosha, which is kind of explaining the Vaibhashika view. For those of you who are coming to the tenets class, from the point of view of the Sautrantika, still Hinayana point of view. So in Asanga's Abhidharma Samuchaya, or compendium of knowledge, you could say, higher knowledge, he says that these 12 links can be summarized into four categories. If you summarize them, there are four types. There are projecting factors, and projected factors. You understand the difference between projecting that which projects, or when we talk about projecting karma, what's another word for that call? Throwing factors or projecting factors, and thrown or projected factors, actualizing factors and actualized factors. So the 12 links can be divided into these four categories. So what are the projecting factors? Who knows? What are the things that project? Anyone know? Or take a guess? Ignorance? Pardon? I didn't catch. You had to project your factors toward me so I can hear your voice. Okay, no, that's going to be different. Here, what he said, the projecting factors are ignorance, karmic formation, and the third link, consciousness. The first, second, and third link are called the projecting factors. What are the projected factors? They are name and form, the six sense bases, contact and feeling. So that's, how many is that? Name and form, six sense bases, contact and feeling. So four more. So that brings us up to the seventh, right? What are the actualizing factors? Craving, grasping, and becoming, or you could call the becoming existence, craving, or say thirst, grasping, and becoming, or existence. So that brings us what to? It was seven, that brings us up to 10. What are the actualized factors? Birth, the 11th link, aging and death, or we could, as I said before, death with or without aging is the 12th link. Do you remember why it's called death? Why you can call it death with or without aging? Because someone, a consciousness could enter into a life, let's say a fertilized egg, one instant, and the next instant die. Or you could take it a little bit longer and say without the visual factors of aging, an embryo might perish, might die without aging. So sometimes it's called death with or without aging. Okay, so divides it up in this way. From this explanation, we can see that there are two stages of this causal sequence. There are projecting causes which plant the projected effects. So what were the projecting causes? Ignorance, that we were talking about in our meditation. Ignorance, so here, just to go back, ignorance is, the word ignorance in Sanskrit is avidya. You don't know Sanskrit. Okay. I've mentioned several times, is a negative, can be a negative particle in Sanskrit. Like also in ignorance, ignorance, the etymology, like G-N-O is a root in what is Greek? Gnosis, knowing. So the letter I that precedes Gnoris, ignorance, is a negative particle also in. So this is how they get avidya. So in the Abhidharma Kosha, it mentions that ignorance can be thought of as an enemy or a falsehood, that which is an enemy or falsehood. So what it means is when you talk about other people other than yourselves, not everyone is an enemy. enemies are those that are somehow antithetical to yourself, that are dangerous to yourself, right? So ignorance, from this Buddhist point of view, the deeper sense of ignorance is not simply not knowing, but it is perceiving something that is false as though it were true, or actually encountering an enemy, which is ignorance. Ignorance is something which is actually not simply a state of not knowing, but something that is perceiving something incorrectly and therefore is harmful to yourself, like an enemy is. So that first link, we were in our meditation, we were trying to recognize how the self appears to your consciousness. Did anyone have any kind of experience of that? Did you get a sense of your own self-identity, the meditator? Or was it too many things to do? Try to focus on the clarity and then this and that. You have to be patient. This is an incredibly important and useful enterprise to recognize that self. So the self that's appearing, does it exist? No, I'm saying the sense that the self that you're sensing, does it exist? Well, yeah, it's appearing. But the object that seems to be, it seems to be inferring, or the object that you're conceiving it to be, that it's really there. It looks to be there, but it's not really there, but your mind believes it to be there. That object that it believes to be there, it does not exist. One thing is existing, like say the mirage, the example of the mirage, or a reflection. Does a reflection exist? Yes. Does a mirage exist? Yes. But if I say the mirage is empty of water, you understand. If I use the word empty, you could say there's no water there, but if I use the word empty just to be use a word that's we're using here when we talk about selflessness and emptiness. So it's not so much that the appearance is the problem, the appearance of the eye. What's the problem is that we believe that to exist. That's the ignorance. That's this avidya. That's the basic ignorance that is like our enemy. It's not the so-called inherently existent I that's the enemy. It's the ignorance itself. The so-called inherently existent I doesn't exist. What does exist is its appearance, an appearance that we conceive to be inherently existent, that ignorance is the actual enemy. That is experienced something that is false. So the projecting causes that plant the projected effects. The projecting causes our ignorance that thereby leads us into creating actions, karmic, it was called karmic formation, forming karma, creating karma. Whenever we create an action, whether it be physical, verbal, or mental, it has a longevity. That is, even when the action is finished, it still has some potential later to bring an effect. We might think, oh, I accidentally stepped on the cockroach. Or maybe you would say you accidentally stepped on it, but you actually intended to step on it because it looked frightening or something. You think that action is finished, but it has a potential. One way of explaining that is that we say that it leaves a karmic seed in our consciousness, right? Another way of explaining it in the Majjhimaka is saying that the ending of the action, let's say stepping on the cockroach, doesn't mean the action is finished. It still the ending of the action is still a functioning thing. You know, some of you studied Majjhimaka. Do you know what I'm talking about? Maybe not, maybe not. Okay. Anyway, it's not so important. We can think of it in the more graphic sense that it leaves a seed in our consciousness. So these are the first three links. The ignorance gives rise to all, you know, to the existence of delusions or the actions that then leave an imprint in my consciousness. That's the third link. And then there are the, from this explanation, we see that there are two stages of this causal sequence. There are the projecting causes, which plant the projected effects. And remember what the projected effects were. There was name and form that comes next, the next four links after that. Then there are the actualizing causes, which bring about the actualized effects. So what were the projecting causes were three in number, and then there were four actualized effects. So there were seven. Then the last five fall in the case of actualized causes and actualized events, effects. The question that is then raised, does this sequence represent one round of rebirth for a given individual? Or is it the description of two cycles? Okay, so this is related to the question that I was asking you, or someone was asking, or I was asking you, how many lifetimes does this represent? Let's go about it, before I go into detail here, let's go about it in another way. Generally, it's said that when you create karma now, you know, due to ignorance, you create karma, it leaves an imprint in your consciousness. That consciousness factor, the third factor, will be present later when it is during the links of craving or thirst, whatever you want to call it, grasping and becoming. What craving or thirst, grasping and becoming are actualizing is that imprint on the consciousness, the third link. They're causing that seed to be put in a situation where it is ready to throw us into another lifetime. Because karma can ripen in other ways other than projecting us into another life, right? Remember, there are four kinds of effects of karma. Were you in the karma class? There's a habitual effect. There's an effect similar to the cause as an experience, like if you killed before, you might be killed. Environmental effects where the environment, or let's say if you talk about the collective karma of sentient beings, the environmental effect is the creation of a new universe. Or your own environmental effect, your own personal effect is the environment that you find yourself in, whether it's noisy, whether it's like right now when all the people are banging these instruments late at night. What is it supposed to be? Supposed to be auspicious or something? Or to be born in a muddy place because of sexual misconduct in previous lives, all sorts of environmental effects. But the most important one is the maturation effect, the first, often if we talk about the four effects. So here we're mainly talking about the maturation effect that throws you into another lifetime, right? So when craving, or in other words, thirst, grasping and becoming, they are actualizing the karmic imprint in the mind so that it can throw us into the next lifetime, which after the craving, grasping, and becoming, the next one is what? Birth, aging, and wither, or death with or without, aging and death, however you want to call it. So between the first three links. And when they're actualized, there's name and form, sixth sense spaces, what? Contact and feeling, right? So one way of understanding it is that in one lifetime, we, due to ignorance, we create karma that leaves an imprint in our mind stream, and there may be intervening lives in which we have name and form, sixth sense spaces, contact, feeling, which are not a result of those, not a result of these particular factors we created right here, the first three factors. Right? There might be many, many lifetimes. If we create a karma, it might be millions of lives later that at the time of death, the craving, the grasping will actualize the karmic seed of the third link so that it is now the karmic, is now the link called becoming. Craving and grasping are delusions, afflictions. Becoming is actually what? Is it a delusion? It's actually karma. It's the karmic seed that has now been fortified by craving and grasping and is ready, is called becoming or existence, because it's in the next instant it's going to give rise to a rebirth. So then you have the next two links of birth and then aging and death. So in that sense, it might, the 12 links might play over millions of lifetimes, but actually we would say that it has a minimum of three lifetimes. Why is that? Why would it be a minimum of three lifetimes? Because in one lifetime you create the karma. Generally, you don't actualize the karma that you create in one lifetime in that same lifetime. Rarely. It's only very, very strong karma that you might create this lifetime, which will bring your next birth in the second life. You know, the next life. What kind of karma could do that? You know, a karma that you create with an object that's a very powerful object, or let's say the actions of immediate retribution. Maybe some heavy kind of karma like schism of the Sangha or something like that. But generally, that will remain, the karma that you create this lifetime will remain on your consciousness for some time in the future, maybe many, many, many lifetimes. And at some time in the future, it will be actualized in a second life, so to speak. And then the projected effect will take place in a third life. Does this make sense? So the intervening lives we're not counting. We're saying that in one life you have the projecting causes. In another life, you'll have the actualizing causes that actualize those, the craving, the ignorance, karmic formation, consciousness. We've left the karmic seed on our mind. How is that karmic seed actualized? It's going to be actualized in another lifetime, generally, not in the same lifetime. And then when are the projected effects and the actualized effects experienced? In another lifetime. So one way of interpreting it is like that. This might be what Geshe-la is referring to as these two different interpretations. But here, this is how generally we, if you studied the 12 links, generally that's what we say. It needs a minimum, the 12 links need a minimum of two lives if it's going to ripen the very next lifetime. It's never experienced in one lifetime. but generally is generally going to require at least three lifetimes. One in which you've planted the seed, another, maybe many, many lifetimes later, in which you fortify that through craving and grasping, so the seed becomes ready to give rise to existence, and then the effects after that. One could also understand, in that way of understanding it, that the links coming after ignorance, karmic formation, and consciousness represent the lives in between. You know, you have name and form that actually were impelled by some other karmic seeds in the past. So there's sort of an interweaving in any one of our lifetimes. We're creating seeds now to have existences in the future, to throw existence into the future. But our present life is the result, even to have ignorance right now has come about because karmic seeds in the past that through this lifetime. So there's an interweaving of these 12 links. Now let me read you what Geshe-la says here about this. My lack of skill here is off the page. Let me get back to this here. So we're talking about this explanation from Asanga's Abhidharma Samuchaya, the Compendium of Knowledge, where he said there are these projecting factors, projected factors, actualizing factors, actualized factors, which could be understood in the way that I just explained or in this other way. So Geshe-la asks, does the sequence represent one round of rebirth for a given individual, or is it a description of two cycles? If these 12 factors represent the cause and effect for only one life, then it seems incorrect to have the set of actualizing factors occurring after the projected factors. What does that mean? What are the actualizing factors? Remember, we said there are projecting causes and projected effects. The projected causes were the first three. The projected effects were the next four, right? So we had seven. Then there are the actualizing factors. What were the actualizing factors? Craving, grasping, coming, and then the actualized effects come after that, the last two, birth and death, essentially, birth, aging, and death. If these 12 factors represent cause and effect for only one life, it seems incorrect to have the set of actualizing factors occurring after the projected factors. The projected factors were the 4, 5, 6, 7, right? The actualizing effects come after that. So generally causes come before effects. So if the projected effects are all of these 12 factors are one lifetime, you've got the actualizing causes coming after their effects. To put it another way, if this sequence represents one cycle of life, why would the projected effects, which are effects, results, why would they come before the actualizing causes, which are the causes, which are their causes if it's one life? Such an order only makes sense if the sequence describes two rounds of rebirth. However, if the 12 links represent two rounds of causality for two different lives, then the actualizing causes of the latter causal sequence appear inadequate to produce a rebirth. Why is that? You've got craving, grasping, and becoming. Well, because it didn't have the ignorance. If the ignorance karmic formation, consciousness, gave birth, were the causes, the projecting causes for, what was it, name and form, what? Six sense bases, contact, feeling. If they were the causes for that, then you don't have any, you don't have anything to be actualized by craving, grasping, and coming, because that ignorance has already been used up. Right? I'm going to put on my glasses here. I have to be careful. If I make this a little bit larger with my fingers, then I, when I touch it again, it zips off to a different place in the text. So I'll put on my glasses. However, the 12 links, so I reiterate the second statement. However, if the 12 links represents two rounds of causality for two different lives, then the actualizing causes of the latter causal sequence appear inadequate to produce a rebirth, because this group lacks ignorance, karmic formation, and causal consciousness. By the same token, the initial causal sequence of projecting causes lacks the actualizing causes of craving, grasping, and existence, so it is inadequate to produce rebirth of the first cycle. So in one sense, this is why it's often said that you're talking about something which is interwoven that takes over three. But let me read what Geshe-la says. To state the problem in the most concise form, if the sequence represents one life, all the projecting and actualizing causes should come before all the projected and actualized effects. And you could interpret it that way. You could say you just take all the factors and rearrange them. Right? But you would never have it in one lifetime. You would have it in two lifetimes. If the sequence represents two lives, then the first life will be lacking the actualizing causes and the second life will be lacking the projecting causes. How do we resolve this apparent contradiction? In general, every life requires all six causes and includes all six results. If you want to read this, you can find in, I think it's book two of Geshe-la's commentary to the Lanrim Chömo, Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. It's on page, I'm reading right now on page 338. How do we resolve this apparent contradiction? In general, every life requires all six causes and includes all six results. Whatever is projected by a projecting cause has to be completed by an actualizing cause. Take my life as an example. So Geshe-la is saying, take my life as an example. At some time in the distant past, three projecting causes were initiated: ignorance, karmic formation, and causal consciousness. In order to yield any result, these projecting causes must be activated by the three actualizing causes of craving, grasping, and becoming. Nothing will be brought into existence without all six of these causes operating together. Well, it doesn't mean in the same life. You can create the karma in one life and they can be actualized a life many times later, many lives later. So they have to form a sequence like that. Name and form, the six sense bases, contact and feeling, were projected by the projecting causes of ignorance, karma, and causal consciousness. They were then brought to fruition by the actualizing causes of craving, grasping, and existence. Thus actualized, those very same projected factors are designated as the actualized effects and are called birth, aging, and death. Therefore, for one person's single life, all the causes have carried out their function before birth. First, the projecting cause projected name and form, the six sense bases, contact and feeling. Then later, when these are brought to fruition, by the actualizing causes, those very same projected factors become the actualized factors of birth, aging, and death. In short, for one life, all the causes must operate before the fruition of the actualized effects. If that's the case, the question becomes, what is the reason for explaining this in terms of two cycles of causality? The reason two sets of causality are shown is in order to point out the difference between the effects of projection and the effects of actualization in terms of their suffering natures. So this is a different kind of explanation than we had talked about before. The projected effects actually remain in a state of dormancy, of potentiality, until such time as they meet the conditions to manifest their actualized state. In other words, at the time they are projected, they do not come into existence in their full actualized nature of suffering. They have the potential so that after the first three factors, the next four are kind of referred to as their potentiality. They're not yet in the experienced in their suffering nature. They are suitable to become factors of suffering, but that will only happen when they meet the actualizing conditions. So if we talk about the first three as the projecting causes, and then the projected effects are not yet, they're just projected in terms of their potentiality. Then you have the actualizing, in some lifetime you have the actualizing causes, craving, grasping, of becoming, and they give rise to the actualizing effects, actualized effects, which are now the same ones that the earlier four, what was it, name and form, six consciousness, six sense bases, contact, feeling, now in their actualized suffering form, not just as potentials. Does it make sense? A little bit complicated. They will only become suffering when they meet the actualizing conditions. We can say that when they are projected, the projecting factors are made suitable to manifest at some time in the future when they meet the necessary actualizing conditions. At that time, they will become factors of suffering. But at the time of projection, this has not yet occurred. For example, and Geshe-la is using himself as an example, in some previous lifetime, perhaps a long time ago, I projected the virtuous karma to be born a human as Geshe Zopa. We can say it was virtuous karma because I am now living as a human being, human life. At that past time, those karmic seeds were planted in this mental continuum by the first, second, and third links. All right? There was that basic ignorance that grasps to a self-supporting, substantially existent I or an inherently existent I that gave rise to delusions that caused the karma that left an imprint in my karmic and in my consciousness. What was planted by that action was the seed or potentiality of the projected effects, the next four links after consciousness, right? The factors of resulting consciousness, well, also resultant consciousness, name and form, six sense bases, contact and feeling. That sounds like five, right? We said, because the consciousness, the third link that we first implanted the consciousness on, remains until it's actually actualized. Then at the time of death in my previous life, when I created that karma, just before I was born in this lifetime, let's say I created the karma many, many lifetimes ago, and in the life just before this one, when he appeared as Geshe Zopa, the actualizing causes, craving, grasping, and becoming, ripened the potentiality and brought about birth in this life. Birth and aging and death. Geshe-la's actually passed away, so he's completed all 12 of those. When we say that the seeds were planted, that the projected effects were projected, it means that they were rendered suitable to manifest when they meet the necessary actualizing factors. Until they meet those necessary conditions, the projected effects remain dormant in a sense of potentiality. This is the meaning of projected effects. Calling them effects does not mean that these factors are already manifest and fully functioning. It does not mean that contact and feeling have already occurred. This is the same as planting a seed in the garden. You can plant the seed in the fall, and it will lay dormant right through the winter, right? Then in the spring, when the ground warms up and the rains fall, that seed sprouts. It is brought into germination by the actualizing causes of warmth and moisture. That's like the craving, grasping, and becoming. It was rendered suitable to be actualized by planting or projecting it in the ground. If you hadn't put the seed there, then no matter how much moisture and warmth had appeared in the spring, you would not have a sprout. The actualized effects of birth, aging, and death are factors that have already been actualized. They are fully manifest, fully functioning, and are therefore conditions of suffering in a current lifetime. Every causal relationship has these two stages, requiring both a primary cause and a secondary actualizing set of conditions. According to this method of explaining the 12 links, there are two different sets of causes and effects that were presented in order to illustrate the difference. So in one sense, one way of explaining it, we're talking about the projected causes. After the first three links, ignorance, karmic formation, consciousness, leaving a karmic seed on that. And it seemed, in one way, it seemed that these, the next four links, were referring to the experiences of that lifetime or in other lifetimes coming. But here, as Geshe-la is explaining, they're referring to the potential of these first three links. Their potential to bring about those effects, which are synonymous with the last two links. So they're said to be an elaboration of birth, aging, and death. Birth meaning name and form, and then the other, during aging, you would have the evolution of the six sense bases, contact and feeling. According to this method of explaining the 12 links, these two different sets of causes and effects were presented in order to illustrate this difference. The projected effects will only become suffering factors of life at some time in the future, possibly many lives after they were planted, because they remain in a dormant state of potential until they are awakened by the actualizing causes. Once those seeds have been awakened by the actualizing causes, the actualized effects ripen immediately as the suffering factors of birth in the next lifetime without any other life intervening. Another reason why these two separate cycles of cause and effect were taught was to emphasize the point that two types of causes are necessary to produce the result of taking rebirth in cyclic existence. Two types of causes. What are the two types of causes? Presenting the 12 links in this manner enable us to distinguish projecting causes from actualizing causes, and to understand how both are necessary to produce that result. So Asanga also wrote in another one of his Mahayana texts, the Yogacara Bhumi, the levels of yogic deeds. He said, since it is the case that the factors from consciousness up to feeling have the character of being intermingled with the factors of birth, aging, and death, why were they taught as two different types? They were taught that way in order to show the different characteristics of things that produce suffering and in order to differentiate between projecting and actualizing. Okay, so that's one way of explaining it. The way that we talked about at the very beginning, very cursorily, very quickly, is this second way of presenting. So far we've been discussing the purpose of showing two causes and effect cycles within the 12 links under the assumption that these 12 links all occurred within one lifetime. When we talked about the projecting causes and actualizing, projecting causes, projected effects, actualizing causes, actualizing effects. However, what becomes evident from the preceding discussion is that these 12 links are presented in a way that seems to fit two separate rounds of dependent origination. The basis, one of the bases, if you go into the detail of this, for the 12 links is one of the sutras that the Buddha taught called the Rice Seedling Sutra. Have you ever heard of that? The Salistamba Sutra. It's kind of alliteration. Salistamba Sutra. One of the primary sources of the Buddha's presentation of the 12 links. It teaches on the face of it a sequence that takes place over two lifetimes. The factors from ignorance through feeling describe one round of dependent origination. The factors from craving through aging and death describe a second round. So taking Geshe as an example again, the 12 links begin with the 2.5 projecting causes. 2.5? Because the third link, consciousness, is actually divided into two. One where you've planted the seed on the consciousness. That consciousness remains with the seed over a long period of time, and then later, it's when it's going to be actualized by craving, grasping, and becoming, that half of that link is called the resultant consciousness. Where are we? Let's again take my life as an example. The 12 links begin with 2.5 projecting causes, ignorance, karma, and the causal stage of consciousness. These projecting causes give rise to a series of projected effects which constitute the experience of my life, from resulting consciousness up to feeling. Then from the activity of feeling, craving arises, which increases into grasping, and finally, just before I die, I perform the actualizing karma of existence or becoming. These are the three actualizing causes, and they occur just before I die. But these three are not the actualizing causes that produced this present lifetime. They are not part of the round of dependent origination that I am experiencing now. What they are actualizing is the next lifetime, another birth, aging, and death. The craving, grasping, and existence that occur just before I die cannot be part of the causality of my present life, my current life, because the causes of this life cannot be happening at the end of my life. Right? These actualizing causes are the causes of a subsequent life, and as such, they are separate. They are part of a separate round of dependent origination. the way the Buddha has presented the 12 links of dependent origination is to first introduce the three projecting causes that produce this life, ignorance, karmic formation, causal consciousness. Then he shows some of the results of those causes which constitute the experience of this life up to feeling. Then near the end of this life, craving arises in dependence upon feeling, and this craving leads to grasping and then to existence. This second causal nexus gives rise to birth, aging, and death, but are actualized causes. But the actualizing causes and its actualized and their actualized results are separate sequence of dependent origination. So this presentation of the 12 links, these different presentations give us an understanding that it's much more subtle, much more, there are many ways of interpreting the 12 links than might appear at first glance. And so the subject of understanding the 12 links requires a greater amount of analysis than just analyzing the Four Noble Truths. Remember when we talked about the main object of contemplation of the hearers in order to escape from cyclic existence are the Four Noble Truths, the Shravakas. The main object of investigation of the Pratika Buddhas, who have longer time, they may spend an eon or more before they actualize nirvana. The main thing they analyze are the 12 links of dependent origination. And after this presentation I've just given, you might say, yeah, I understand why. It would take me at least an eon to understand what you're talking about. So there are, but one can understand, let's say, if we understand them in different ways. In one lifetime, due to ignorance, you create karma, leave an imprint in your consciousness. And then there may be many intervening lifetimes where there are, you are born with name and form, you have your evolution of your sense bases, contact, and you create feeling. In those lifetimes. In those lifetimes, upon feeling, you start to create another set of 12 links. Due to ignorance, you create karma, leaving more seeds in your consciousness. So that, in one way of understanding, those next four links refer to all the lifetimes in between when you created the karma and when that karma is actually actualized sometime in the future due to craving, grasping, and becoming. And as a result of that, the last two factors of birth and death are different. They're going to refer to a different life than the four links in between. That's one way of understanding it. Another way of understanding it is that these four factors after the first three are the potential to experience suffering. They actually refer to the last two links. So understanding in that way, going back between these various interpretations, you start to understand that in any one lifetime, we are experiencing the results of many past cycles of the 12 links. Different parts of them are being experienced now. We are creating the causes with every instant of our mind, creating karmic seeds in our consciousness. They have many, many lifetimes in the future. Unless those karmic seeds are destroyed. How can we destroy the karmic seeds? Well, the seeds to have births in the upper realms can be destroyed inadvertently by anger, by abandoning the Dharma, by causing, heavy karmas like that. But the negative karma can be destroyed by applying the four opponent forces. We'll be talking more about that in the next talk on karma. So before I go any further, let me ask if you have any questions. You're probably a bit confused. Yes.
Clear about these 12 dependent links. So my takeaway from the various ways that the 12 links have been presented is that what one experiences in one lifetime is actually an overlapping of several 12 links.
That's one way of understanding.
Yeah, so there's overlapping of several cycles. Right. And then what one experiences also that can be an interplay between several cycles. Is that correct?
Again?
So what one experiences in one lifetime can be actually an interplay between between several cycles of the 12 links. Is my understanding correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Then. So you can end up with actually quite a whole matrix of different permutations arising from several cycles interplaying with each other.
I think that's where the complexity arises, and that's where we'd like to make it more simple, but by understanding it that way, you start to understand our plight right now, that we're caught up with causes that we created in the past that are ripening now. Some of those causes from the past still remain in our consciousness that might be actualized in this lifetime or in future lifetimes. Mm-hmm. Even not talking about projecting the causes that project us into other rebirths, if you think of the karma that's on our mind stream that will just arise in these other three effects, environmental effects, experiences in this lifetime of that are similar to the cause that we created in the past as an experience or as a as an action, you know, habitual effect. All of these, you know, contemplating all of that starts to develop a very strong feeling of revulsion for cyclic existence. You understand the plight that we find ourselves in, and one wants to then try to find a way to extricate ourselves from this. So this gets into the other aspect of talking about the 12 links in their forward order and the reverse order, both in what's called the purified form and afflicted form. So what does this mean? This means once you recognize the situation that we find ourselves in, you develop a desire to get out. How can you get out? How can you get out of this cycle? Well, you can start from the beginning. You can say that if I cease ignorance. Yeah, good. Get rid of ignorance. I will not create karmic formation. I won't form karma, that throwing karma, for instance. Without throwing karma, I won't leave an imprint on my mind stream, and so there won't be anything to be actualized by craving, grasping, and becoming. The potentials of name and form and six sense bases, contact and feeling, or birth and death. So you can go in the forward order like that, or you can go in the reverse order. If I want to cease aging and death, well, what do I have to do? I have to cease what? Birth. Rebirth. if I don't want to age and die, if I don't want to have lives that are filled with aging, which epitomizes suffering and death, I have to stop rebirth. How do I stop rebirth? I have to stop becoming, the link that comes right before that. How do I stop becoming? I have to stop what has brought about the becoming, the grasping. How do I stop that? I have to cease the thirst that has intensified into grasping. And so basically going backwards through the 12 links in that way, you come back to, at the beginning, you have to cease ignorance the same way. So you come to the same conclusion. If I cease ignorance, I will cease karmic formation and so forth. Moving backwards from the end to the beginning, you also come to the same conclusion that you have to cease ignorance. So that, what is that ignorance? That ignorance is not simply a not knowing. As I said before, so sometime in the Abhidharma teachings, they say there are two kinds of ignorance. Simply the ignorance of not knowing the law of cause and effect, in which case you may engage in negative activities that have all of these consequences. But that's not the main ignorance. That is an ignorance. But here the avidya, or the, in Tibetan we say marigpa, is ma is a negative particle, or ignorance. So it's not ignorance. Like gnosis, you know the word gnosis? G-N-O-S-I-S, or Gnostic. It has that same sense of knowing. So the I letter beforehand serves the same to indicate a negative particle. Here the main one is the sense of being an enemy or being a falsehood. It's this ignorance, the main ignorance, is not just not knowing, it's actually consciously grasping at something which is false, believing it is true. It's a misdirected wisdom. It's actually an enemy, that consciousness. It's not just a lack of, it's not like just like a stranger who might be analogous to not knowing something. It's actually an enemy which is leading us in the wrong way. So what one is motivated then to try to eliminate this ignorance. And how does one eliminate the ignorance? By developing its antidote. What is the antidote to ignorance? Will it sort of decay over time of its own accord? Well, that's interesting. A couple of you are going, no. Even as you are texting, you know that was apparent. Ignorance doesn't disappear of its own accord. What about in life? If someone is ignorant as a youth, does that ignorance disappear over time? You might say, oh yeah, as you get older, that ignorance disappears. How does that ignorance disappear? Through education, right? By developing your wisdom. In the same way here, this ignorance, maybe we could say that you have to mature as a spiritual being by developing, by being educated and developing the understanding ultimately that recognizes this fundamental ignorance that's grasping to an inherently existent I. You have to develop the wisdom that sees what that ignorance is doing. You have to recognize how it's functioning, that it's conceiving of an inherently existent I that doesn't really exist through the appearance of an inherently existent I. The appearance does exist. And then you have to recognize, you have to develop the reasoning that proves that so-called inherently existent I does not exist at all. This is the famous reasoning. G- Geshe Zopa mentioned in these teachings, and all of the great teachers say that in order to realize emptiness, you have to develop this wisdom. And that takes a lot of work. The reason that we haven't done it in previous lifetimes, even when we've encountered the teachings over maybe several lifetimes, we've followed the path, but we've never brought it to conclusion. And then whatever little spark of wisdom we developed, we didn't bring to conclusion to really eradicate this ignorance. It was never eradicated before, this basic ignorance. So what we need to do is to have a sustained period of developing that wisdom. How do we get the sustained period? We need to have a continuity of lifetimes where we're born as a human, encounter the teachings, and we can keep on refining that understanding. How do we have a continuum of human rebirths? We need to practice ethics, morality. So from one point of view, you need to have wisdom that counteracts the ignorance. That wisdom has to be supported by concentration. Otherwise, it's just something fleeting. That concentration is brought about, let's say that continuity also, that concentration and continuity is brought about by a succession of rebirths that are based on the practice of ethics. Without practicing ethics, you won't be born as a human again in the future. So a little bit the modern fascination with certain facets of Buddhism, like mindfulness, from a Buddhist perspective is a little bit misguided, a great deal misguided, because it's not at all concerned with the development of wisdom. It's just finding some present calmness of mind by being mindful, making your present life more bearable. There was a conference of Buddhist teachers in India maybe 20, 25 years ago. I wasn't present at that conference, but I talked to the gentleman who had convened it. The Dalai Lama was asked to attend. And at one point, the person who had convened the conference told me when I talked to him later, his name is Surya Das. He was a teacher at some points, a Western teacher. So he said at one point some of the participants were saying that at the Buddhist centers, as Buddhism is being taught in the West, we should have more things that integrate Western psychology and transactional groups, they call them tea groups, and maybe massage therapy and the different things like this. And His Holiness was present while the whole group had broken into small groups, and His Holiness happened to be in this small group where a couple people were mentioning this. And His Holiness sort of took the aspect of being, sort of questioning this, thinking in his mind. He said, I always thought that the Buddhist teaching was not how to make your samsara better. Buddhist teaching is how to get out of samsara. That's the main import. So how to get out of samsara is something that's not so much addressed by a lot of the New Age Buddhist teachings. It emphasized mainly mindfulness, and leave off ethics, morality, and concentration. Mindfulness and so forth are always part of the Buddhist teachings, but they have to be utilized in the right way with this goal of eradicating ignorance. So there are other ways to categorize the 12 links. What did we add? We said the first three were projecting causes, the next four were projected effects, the next three were actualizing causes, and the last two were actualized effects. Another way to categorize the 12 links, as Nagarjuna explained in a text that he wrote called The Heart of Dependent Origination, or Heart of Dependent Arising, these 12 can be categorized as afflictions, karma, and sufferings. And so we mentioned this at the very beginning. The first, the eighth, and the ninth are afflictions. What are those? Ignorance, craving, and grasping. The second and tenth are sufferings. Oh, no, sorry. The second and tenth are karma. The second link is what? Karmic formation. The tenth is becoming. Becoming, remember the link of becoming or existence, it's actually just a name referring to this karmic seed that is on our mind stream, which has been actualized by craving and becoming. It's called existence or becoming because it's craving and grasping, rather. It is called becoming or existence because it's given the name of its result. What's going to come about is another lifetime, another existence. So it's called existence. Sometimes things are given the name of their results. Like say, for instance, you plant a seed of an apple tree in your garden and you say, I've planted an apple tree. Have you planted an apple tree? Why do you say you planted an apple tree? Because you planted the cause of the apple tree. You're calling it you say that you've planted an apple tree by giving the name of the result to the cause, right? Does that make sense? Also, sometimes we give the name, we name something by its cause. Many, many reasons for doing this. So the second and tenth are karma. The remaining seven are sufferings. This is what Nagarjuna said. So Nagarjuna calls these categories paths, plural of path. So he's saying that the factors of ignorance, craving, and grasping are the path of afflictions. Karma and existence, or becoming, are the paths of karma. And the other seven factors are all the paths of suffering. In the Rice Seedling Sutra, the Buddha, holding up a green rice sprout as an example, taught the 12 links of dependent origination and presented them in terms of four causes leading to rebirth. The analogy he used in this sutra is a little bit different from the usual one we encounter. The one that we usually encounter is that karma is the seed and consciousness is the field in which it is planted, right? Instead, in the Rice Seedling Sutra, the Buddha likened ignorance to the planter, the agent who plants the seed. Karma itself is like a field in which the seed is planted. And the seed that is planted is actually the seed of consciousness, specifically causal consciousness. When that seed is moistened by the water of grasping, it becomes the sprout of name and form in the mother's womb. In this analysis, it is the planter, the field, the seed, and the supporting condition of moisture, ignorance, karma, causal consciousness, and grasping, that together produce the birth of the being in the womb. Okay. So when you read different explanations of the 12 links, you may find different of these explanations emphasized. So to know that it can be interpreted in all of these different ways, even though you may not be completely conversant right now with any one of them, at least you won't be confused at the time another explanation is given, because you can see that there are different ways of interpreting it. As this is the second of this class, and we've got a little bit time left, are there any other questions that you wanted to address? Yeah.
Venerable, I have a question regarding the three poisons, which is the center of the picture of the 12 links. It is said that ignorance is the root of the other two poisons, anger and attachment. And in turn, the other two, anger and attachment promotes even more ignorance. So how do we eliminate this vicious cycle? Because if we eliminate one, the other two will just produce even more ignorance again.
So in that particular drawing that you have, if you look at it, you see that the pig, out of the pig's mouth, are coming the chicken and the snake, right? It's coming out of the mouth of the pig. In some representations, they're separated. The three of them are separate. So in the presentation, when they're separate, that would be more like understanding ignorance as on an equal footing with attachment and hatred. That would be the kind of ignorance which is just not knowing, which that sense of not knowing can be intensified or recreated by attachment and hatred and so forth. But the main meaning of ignorance here is not just not knowing the effects of karma, not knowing the law of cause and effect, in which case you engage into actions that are unskillful due to, let's say, all of the things that arise out of attachment and hatred. But this ignorance is referring to that sense of the ignorance which is misperceiving reality. That's the fundamental cause of attachment and hatred. Due to this grasping to a self-identity, if you watch your own mind, you may do some experiments in the laboratory of your mind. Because of that belief, the grasping to an I that seems to exist there, we give rise to attachment. Out of the belief in that I, assenting to that appearance of an I, believing that there is a real I here, we give rise to hatred, anger. All of the other delusions arise out of that. Aryadeva was a disciple of Nargarjuna. Aryadeva was also one of the great writers of the Mahayana. He wrote a text that some of you may have encountered called the 400 Yogic Deeds of Bodhisattvas. It's a nice translation of it by Ruth Sonam. In one of the very famous verses of that, Aryadeva says, just as the body sense organ pervades all of the body and all of the other senses, ignorance pervades all of the other delusions. Have you ever heard that verse? So what does that mean? Say, for instance, the eye organ here mainly perceives visual forms and, you know, shapes and colors. The actual eye organ is not the eyeball, the iris, or the fluid within its actual subtle matter. Even within the retina, even the rods and cones that science would recognize are not the eye sense power, but something, a subtle matter within that. But if you were to pierce that, the eye and the retina and so forth with a pin, you would feel some suffering, because the body sense consciousness, which pervades our skin and our, you know, that we feel with, that we feel hot and cold, that we feel pain and pleasure with our body sense, that pervades all of the other senses. It pervades our ear sense, our nose sense, our tongue sense, our, In that same way that the body sense power pervades all of the other senses, it is present in the eye, it's present in the ear, and so forth. In the same way, whenever you have attachment, hatred, jealousy, pride, low self-esteem, depression, all of it is pervaded by the presence of this basic kind of ignorance that is misperceiving reality. Not just the ignorance that doesn't know right from wrong, but the ignorance that's grasping to an inherently existent self. That pervades all of the delusions in the sense that it is always present and is the, sort of like the factor that gives rise to them. If you were to eliminate that ignorance, that misperception of the self, all of the other delusions would no longer have a basis for being generated. That's a little bit the sense of why the snake and the chicken are coming out of the mouth of the pig in that particular representation of the 12 links. So that particular representation, where they're not three separate animals, but the two of them are coming out of the mouth of the pig, it's kind of illustrating this sense that all of the delusions come about because of the fundamental root of all of the delusions, the grasping to the sense of an inherently existing I. So that inherently existent I, as it's the cause, the fundamental root of attachment and hatred, if you were to eliminate it, the other two would be eliminated. Attachment and hatred would be eliminated. Attachment and hatred don't have the capacity to create ignorance anew, whereas ignorance has the capacity to create attachment and hatred. Because that was kind of like your question implied that, or you stated explicitly that attachment can give rise to more ignorance, hatred can give rise to more ignorance. So rather than that, it's actually that ignorance gives rise to attachment and hatred and all of the other 84,000 delusions. Once you cut it off, that's kind of the insight of the 12 links. When you go understand how the 12 links throw us into cyclic existence, once you cut off ignorance, you no longer will take rebirth within cyclic existence due to the uncontrolled karma and delusion. You no longer create delusions, because there'll be no craving and grasping at the time of death. So the person who's realized emptiness directly, they may have karmic seeds on their mind stream that could give rebirth in the various, you know, lower rebirths, upper rebirths within cyclic existence. But at the time of death, the craving and grasping that will modify those karmic seeds, bring them up to the point of becoming where they're ready to throw you into another rebirth, they will not function. Those factors will not be there because they are actually delusions. And once you've eliminated ignorance, all of the other delusions lose their effectiveness. They no longer function. So no one will no longer create those modifying factors of craving and grasping, so no one won't be thrown into cyclic existence. So it has to, it has significance both when you eliminate ignorance, you no longer will be reborn in cyclic existence due to uncontrolled karma delusion. Also, you no longer will create any delusion. If you no longer create any delusions or afflictions, you don't create any karma. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah. Oh, have I gone over? Oh, I've gone over. I thought it was going to be 12:30. I'm sorry. I thought we still had time. But why don't we? If you have a question, I will stay and answer. But let's just dedicate. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I noticed some people beginning to leave. Let's try to recall the clear light nature of the mind that we were meditating on at the beginning, just to calm our mind. See if you can develop a remembering consciousness of that. Sense that subjective mind rather than the objective thoughts, and let your mind calm for a moment. And within that calmness, recall that we've created some virtuous karma this morning, listening to this difficult subject, contemplating it, weighing it in our mind, with a positive motivation that we tried to set at the beginning to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others. So we've created some virtuous karma. Whatever way this ripens, may it become the cause of my continued spiritual development from life to life until I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. So that finishes this two talks on the 12 links. There'll be a concluding talk on two talks on the Majjhimaka philosophy when this Sunday, I guess. What? No, this Sunday? No, next Sunday. Right? Tomorrow? Tomorrow? Is it tomorrow? Yeah, tomorrow. Yeah, we'll talk about Majjhimaka, and then. On the following Thursday, there will be one final lecture on karma. So if you have some more questions, come on then. Anyway, thank you. I'm sorry I had gone over a couple minutes. If you have some other questions, you can either remain or come on up. Thank you. Oh, you're very kind. Thank you. I should delay. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.